Okay. The story is we are certainly being recording. We may or may not be live, but recording will be enough. So let us begin. And with that, Gerard, would you start and let us know 3 to 5 minutes what you think are the major issues we should consider.
Well, I think one of the major issues is the trying to achieve consistency in applications of the standards. And I've always wondered, because being a member of a national standard setter, we do engage the big fours. And I think almost everywhere the big accounting auditing firms will be involved at the forefront of interpreting accounting standards. And I thought in my mind, we have to engage them and make sure that they are unanimous in agreement in the interpretation of standards that we release. It wouldn't help us if all over the world, different accounting firms or firms belonging to the same group all have their own interpretation. So if they can be united, I think it'll go a long way to help us to achieving consistency. Because I cannot imagine any standard setter, national standard setter, not consulting the big firms.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. The financial reporting faculty of ICAW formulates the Institute's policy on financial reporting issues, and I'm a member of the working party that's currently assessing the trustees' strategy paper, so any views that I express today are preliminary ones, although we have started our considerations. ICAW has been a persistent champion of the cause of the creation of global accounting standards, so I'd like to start off by formally congratulating the trustees and the ISB on the truly remarkable progress that's been made over the last 10 years or so. Since 2004, I think, the ICAW has commented at each stage of the reviews of the governance and the strategy of the foundation, and we've been represented at each of the public hearings held in London over that time. I'm very pleased to acknowledge that our concerns in this area have in the main been taken on board over that period, so thank you for that. There does remain much to be done, and we thus welcome the timing of the current strategy review, issued at a critical juncture in the evolution of the ISB as a global standard setter of profound economic significance, we think. Now, a precondition of that continued success, in our view, is the achievement of a widely accepted governance structure and a very well-respected due process arrangement, and we think an ongoing process of debate, reform, and renewal in this area is thus very important. We also broadly welcome the scope and the content of the strategy paper, which provides some valuable clarification on issues which we think are central to the debate about the future direction and priorities of the trustees and the ISB. And I'd like at this stage just to touch quickly on three main issues in the interest of time under A1, A2 and C6 in the paper. So firstly, on the Foundation's mission, we very strongly support the focus in A1 on the primacy of the needs of investors, and hence on transparency as the core purpose of financial reporting. Accounting solutions, we think, should be determined primarily to meet investors' information needs and not, for example, to further other economic or public policy objectives. Of course, the ISB should have a full and a frank dialogue with key regulators on an ongoing basis, and of course, transparency and integrity in the reporting system are absolutely vital components of a stable financial system. But prudential supervision and financial stability should always be delivered through regulatory regimes, principally. And we do think that regulators should have no particular influence over the determination of the detailed requirements of accounting standards. And I think the clarity now provided by the trustees is an important step forward in this area in view of recent uncertainty on this point. I think we all need to ensure that the core principle is well understood and adhered to in practice, both in terms of the financial statements and the accompanying management commentary. Moving on again to mission, we strongly agree with the conclusion in A2 that convergence is a means to an end and not an end in itself. It's entirely proper that each jurisdiction determines at what pace and by which route their journey to IFRS is undertaken. But adoption has to be the ultimate objective and indeed the primary aspiration of the foundation. I think it's fair to say here that UK experience from 2005 in seeking to converge our standards with IFRS by means of a gradual process highlighted some of the drawbacks of such an approach, giving rise to a degree of complexity in the accounting framework. And in this context, we see many benefits flowing from an early decision by the SEC to firmly steer the United States on a certain and a well-defined course towards IFRS reporting. And thirdly and lastly, under due process and benchmarking, the trustees at C6 call for ISB to establish a dedicated research facility to provide thought leadership in financial reporting. Now, we very much support the general thinking behind this recommendation. We believe strongly in the importance of ensuring that standard-setting activities, and especially major agenda decisions and discussion papers, take full account of relevant accounting research and are always fully evidence-based. We don't think this need involve building an extensive and an expensive in-house research capacity, more the allocation of some resource to undertaking comprehensive early-stage literature reviews, engaging with relevant academics, and liaising with national standard setters, professional accountancy bodies, and other organisations that already undertake and sponsor accounting research. And it might also be helpful for the foundation to set out the criteria by which it would assess the relevance of such research. If successful, I think this process might help identify likely impacts and contentious issues related to potential projects, and hence lead to better agenda decisions in future. ICAW enjoys a close and fruitful relationship with the global academic community and would stand ready to help in this endeavour. I hope to add some comments on other issues later on and look forward to hearing the views of the other participants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter.
Okay. I'm speaking today for the Quoted Company Alliance that I'm a member of the Financial Reporting Committee of. Quoted Company Alliance, or QCA, works for small and mid-cap quoted companies, so we're not SMEs, we're in the main listed companies. But QCA is the founder member of European Issuers, and as such represents 9,000 quoted companies in 14 European countries, so quite a number of IFRS users. In terms of the strategy paper, we broadly agree with the proposals. However, we think they're a bit high level and would like a bit more granularity. And the most important thing from the QCA position probably is what isn't there rather than what is there. We feel that, in general, smaller listed companies tend to be the forgotten sector. Although by number they constitute a large proportion, a large population of IFRS users, and in economic terms they're a major source of economic growth. And from an IFRS point of view, in terms of the global reach mission, they are important because as IFRS extends to more and more countries, the number of small caps using it is going to increase and it's going to be a greater proportion. The cost-benefit profile for small caps is very different to that for larger entities. The best example is less dedicated financial resources to be able to cope with the changes. And therefore, they've seen IFRS often as an expensive imposition. Because of proliferation of disclosure requirements, confusion over application and materiality, and other reasons. And we feel the strategy should address issues from the perspective of small caps. What could we do to improve the position for small caps? I think our whole thing is around proportionality of requirements, which has some imperatives in terms of how standards are written, using principles-based standards, clear use of materiality, etc. But we think there's probably a need for a specific project to assess the application difficulties and the extent of benefit of use of IFRS by smaller quoted companies. which can inform future future strategy. What would we want to see in strategy? We'd like to see members of the ISB and other bodies with small cap experience, and we feel the way things go at the moment mitigates against people of that kind in major roles. Cost-benefit considerations to be looked at when standards are being developed, particularly in terms of the field testing and the effect analysis, the post-implementation review, and as part of the due process, and proportionality to be something, a criteria in terms of the monitoring. And finally, we'd like to see the strategy, as I've said, include a project to assess the application difficulties of smaller caps with IFRS.
Peter, our paper does talk about a number of the issues that you mentioned, cost-benefit analysis, field testing, post-implementation reviews. Would you have us say things differently from the way we've said them?
No, I think, as I said at the beginning, I think we broadly agree with the main thrust of the way things are going. I think we'd like to see, in a way, more mention of the smaller cap sector and an understanding of the difficulties and an understanding also of their importance in terms of the application of IFRS going forward, because we think probably too much emphasis tends to be placed on the larger brethren, of whom there are a number of representatives today.
And to be clear, what you're talking about is small cap publicly traded.
Correct.
Not SMEs. Yeah.
SMEs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Jeff?
Thank you. Good morning. Appreciate the opportunity to participate at this roundtable. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with my employer, the Council of Institutional Investors is a not-for-profit association based in Washington, D.C. Although we have a number of international members, the voting members of the Council who establish our policies consist of large, medium, and small public, corporate, and union employee benefit plans located throughout the United States. Those plans have invested assets exceeding $3 trillion. And importantly, about 25% of those assets are invested in non-U.S. equities and fixed income securities. Since our formation in 1985, the Council has viewed its mission as educating and advocating on behalf of those members in support of corporate governance best practices on a broad range of issues. It's our view that good corporate governance practices that the companies our members invest in can enhance long-term shareowner value. The best practices that we advocate on behalf of our members are set forth in a comprehensive set of policies and related statements that are available to the public, can be downloaded from our website at www.cii.org. For many years, the Council's policies have explicitly recognized that high-quality financial accounting and reporting is a critical element of good corporate governance and essential to the health of our capital markets, and that the responsibility to promulgate accounting standards should reside with independent private sector organizations. Of course, the financial reporting issue that has been of greatest interest to our members in recent years has been the U.S. SEC's consideration of a plan to transition from U.S. GAAP to IFRS. Back at our October 2008 membership meeting, after months of deliberations and informed by consultation with a broad range of investors within and outside of our membership and some of the leading financial accounting and reporting experts in the U.S. and elsewhere, including ISB Chair Sir David Tweedy, Council members approved a statement that generally supports U.S. FASB and the SEC working cooperatively with the International Accounting Standards Board, the IFRS Foundation, and other international standard-setting bodies, quote, toward a common goal of convergence to a single set of high-quality standards, unquote. That statement, however, generally opposes the replacement of U.S. GAAP and the U.S. Accounting Standards Center with IFRS and the ISB, respectively, unless and until seven criteria have first been met. Those criteria intended to provide some level of assurance that U.S. investors will not be disadvantaged in either the short or the long term by a movement to international standards and standards set by the ISB for U.S. companies. We're pleased that many of our seven criteria have been adopted by the U.S. SEC as part of their work plan for the consideration of incorporating IFRS into the financial reporting system for U.S. issuers. To further educate our members on this topic and to provide some additional input to the SEC's consideration of this issue, earlier this month, the Council issued a white paper prepared by Professor Donna Street with the University of Dayton. That paper, which is available on our website, is titled Criteria for an Independent Accounting Standards Setter, How Does the ISB Rate? Unquote. Professor Street's paper, again available on our website, summarizes the academic literature and other available information that, in her view, may be relevant to an evaluation of whether IFRS and the ISB satisfy the seven criteria set forth in the Council's statement. While the evidence and other related information cited by Professor Street's paper demonstrates that the ISB has made great progress towards satisfying several of the Council's criteria, there is limited evidence contained in the white paper to support inclusion that all of the seven criteria have been met. That said, the trustee's ongoing strategy review provides an opportunity to make further progress towards satisfying the Council's criteria, and I would respectfully request that the trustees carefully consider the Council's criteria and the related information contained in Professor Street's white paper as part of this ongoing review. And in that regard, let me briefly just share with you my personal observations on two of the areas identified in the trustee strategy review. First, with respect to the organization's financing, the Council's policy provides that the International Standards Center must have, quote, sufficient resources, including a secure, stable source of funding that is not dependent on voluntary contributions of those subject to the standards, unquote. In evaluating this criterion, Professor Street's white paper indicates that the current funding of the ISB is neither sufficient, secure, nor stable. The white paper also notes that more than a third of the ISB's funding continues to be derived from voluntary contributions from those subject to its standards. The trustees' April report in paragraphs D1 and D2 sets forth proposed principles on improving the funding system. Those principles, which focus on independent, long-term, public-sponsored financing, would appear to be entirely consistent with the Council's funding criterion. Given sound principles, it's now important, in my mind, that the trustees work with the monitoring board and others to promptly act on those principles so that U.S. investors and others can have some comfort that the IFRS Foundation, the ISB, have the amount and type of financing necessary, in the trustees' words, to, quote, safeguard the IFRS Foundation's position as the world's independent accounting standards setter, unquote. My second observation relates to the process and procedures of the IFRS Foundation. The Council has a criterion that provides that the International Accounting Standards Setter must have a structure and process in place that, quote, adequately protects the standard setter's technical decisions and judgments for being overridden by government officials or bodies, unquote. Professor Street's white paper describes in some detail the difficult political pressures that the ISB has faced in the past and will likely continue to face in the future. Pressures with respect to the timing and substance of standards that more likely than not lead the ISB in the direction that's inconsistent with the needs and demands of investors. When reviewing comments and proposals to further expand the responsibilities of the trustees, including those in Section C of the trustees' April report, I personally grow increasingly concerned that as the trustees take on more and more responsibilities, that they will be less and less able to devote the time and resources to their more critical functions. In my mind, perhaps the most critical of those functions is the role of the trustees in communicating to the world's policymakers and other constituents the benefits to the functioning of the global capital markets and the economy of having an independent, private sector accounting standard setting organization with a thorough public due process whose primary focus is on serving the needs of investors to make economic allocation decisions. If the IFRS Foundation does not actively and aggressively pursue this advocacy function, the organization will, in my opinion, not be able to withstand the political pressures that are certain to reoccur, and if they are unable to defend against those pressures, ultimately the foundation and the organization will fail in its mission. With those two brief observations, let me conclude my opening remarks by again thanking the trustees for inviting me to participate at this important meeting, and I look forward to today's discussion.
Jeff, let me thank you very much. Let me make one or two clarifying comments and then ask you a couple of questions, if I might. On the issue of financing, I think the trustees have sought to be very clear that what is in the paper is a blueprint for the future, and have never asserted that the current financing in all jurisdictions meets those. And indeed, in the U.S., I think we would be very fast, quick, and we have stated that it doesn't meet those criteria.
Right.
Sounds to me like you agree with the criteria we set out for the future. And this is indeed, in the case of many, several jurisdictions, aspirational. On the other hand, I think from the U.S. perspective, that you and I share, were or when the SEC agrees to some mechanism of incorporation option, it would be quite possible to work out funding arrangements on the back of that, which would be consistent with these. On the issue of independence and thorough due process, which you cite, and your concerns about, do you think that we've been adequate in the paper in expressing our commitment to those? Is the concern that the paper does not sufficiently commit us to independence of the process and thorough due process? Or is it just a concern that moving forward we would have our attention diverted?
The latter. I think, you know, there's several important functions that you have. Ensuring that there's sufficient funding is obviously very important.
Sure.
But I would also put high up on the list this function that I just mentioned about advocating and around the world to policymakers and others about the importance of what you do, why it's important to the markets, why it's important to the global economy, because there will be challenges, there has been in the past, and there will be in the future. And unless the trustees are committed to devoting their time and resources to that part of their function, I think you're going to continually run into problems which, say, ultimately could lead to failure of your mission.
I think this is a very reasonable set of concerns. You and I, because we share the U.S. experience, know very well that even in the U.S., the standard setter has come under pressure from time to time, not dissimilar from
Absolutely.
The pressures on the IASB, and that it is an important role of the trustees, and they need to be ever vigilant to defend the board from those pressures. Now,
you and I have discussed, I think that also plays into the selection of trustees, who should be on the foundation, because I think that's such an important role that has to be an important part of the selection criteria.
Thank you very much. Kayode?
Kayode. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm speaking for the IFRS team from AO Partners. I'm a certified fraud examiner and a professional member of the Information Systems Auditing and Control Association. We largely agree with the mission of the IFRS trustees stated, and as well as the governance, the three-tier structure. We believe it is adequate and appropriate. However, as regards the governance, specifically the representation of the on the monitoring board, we believe that the monitoring board should be expanded to reflect a wider range of global jurisdictions as well as other institutions that support the IFRS. Particularly, the IFRS adoption is fast being embraced throughout the world in regions such as Africa, Latin and South America, Oceania and Asia. putting in view that the Constitution declares that the new ISB will be focused on creating standards aimed at investor protection. We should recall that members of the small capital markets, as well as SMEs, are in most cases the driving force of the economies of emerging markets, and these SMEs often seek investments from larger organizations, which are larger multinationals, which are members of the larger capital markets, that is, the prospective investors. Consequently, we believe that the current monitoring board should ideally consist of representatives of members of the small and large capital markets. This should allow for the adequate representation of not-for-profit organizations as well as members of the small capital markets and SMEs. For instance, in Nigeria, we intend to adopt the IFRS for SMEs in 2014, and then we're moving towards the adoption of IFRS in 2012. Also, on the area of process, in the review document on page 16, the third paragraph in the C2 section, we note that the trustees' due process oversight committee should review and discuss due process compliance regularly throughout the standard setting process and at the end of the process before a standard is finalized. While we commend this effort, we wish to state our views that the particular meeting periods, web or, if possible, dates should be stated as against the indeterminate period that is regularly stated in the review document. Also, as on the area of due process as regards the global adoption of IFRSs, on page 10 of the review document, on the fourth paragraph, we support the trustees' unrelenting move towards the long-term goal, the adoption of the IFRS, while working with the national standard setters of the various countries. However, we are of the opinion that a time frame should be assigned to this goal and not left open-ended. On the area of financing, we believe that the monitoring board should be responsible for working with the capital market regulators, for example, the IOSCO, that is to establish a levy to allow the foundation to fund its operations. We also believe that each country that has adopted the IFRS should assume greater responsibility in mobilizing institutions to contribute resources to the foundation and on an annual basis. We recommend that the trustees work with the monitoring board to propose putting such a levy system in place. Also, still on financing, as regards the IFRS user fees, we would like to see in the long run a situation where the standards would be available at no charge to anyone who wishes to view or download them. This will particularly be useful for users in developing economies. Such a move will help increase the spread of IFRS's knowledge among stakeholders in these economies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me just make a couple of comments in response to what you've said. On funding, the trustees faced a problem that you suggest. We had to decide how specific we would be in recommending funding regimes. Respecting the various jurisdictions with which we have to deal and their rightful independence and authority, we felt that the best thing for us was to make some statements about general principles rather than initiate ourselves directions for them to take. We thought if they could respect these principles, we should allow the flexibility of different regimes to adopt different financing mechanisms, so long as they met these objectives. and not go so far as to make statements about specific financing regimes. And so, I mean, that's the tension we faced. On the involvement of the Due Process Committee, talked about having even more specific timetables. What we have done in this paper is suggest that the Due Process Committee will be involved throughout the standard-setting process, which is quite a change from its current practice, which would be, which has been to be more involved at the end of the standard-setting process. So we have moved to a elongated involvement of those. We haven't gone so far as to have specific timetables, but this is for us quite a step forward in the direction to the Due Process Committee to increase its involvement in making certain that throughout the process, due process is respected by the IASB.
Can I ask if I may? The
I think you just turned it off.
Thank you. Okay, I couldn't see. Elements of what happens in the due process do have fixed timescales. I'd be interested in how you see an advantage over what is the system that Bob has just described, as, which in effect is continuous involvement, given that you have to have a series of agreed steps in the due process, but events and other things occur, and is there a risk that if you go for rigid timescales, you reduce the flexibility of responding to stakeholders and to events?
I believe if, considering that we're talking about the decade now, if time frames are set at it, where in cases where, you know, not so as not to make it absolutely rigid and not allow for stakeholder involvement, but the notwithstanding, with time frames in place, it allows one to benchmark progress towards the what we have as a common goal, or what the IFRS trustees have as a common goal within this particular decade.
I mean, there is a timetable of that sort in the work program. I mean, we're very infamous in not meeting those timeframes as we go along. But when we do start a project, we have a broad idea of when there'll be a discussion paper, when there'll be an exposure draft. Yeah. But as Brian said, so there is a target, but we very seldom meet those targets, and it's generally because happenings intervene and different, and, you know, people want more time, or we have more discussion, or we run across problems we hadn't anticipated, and all those sorts of things. But I think as a general principle, we do try to have an overall timetable, but it often gets tripped up.
Good, thank you. Thank you very much. Peter?
Thank you. Just to remind you, I'm representing EFRAG today, where I'm a member of the Supervisory Board. First off, I'd like to thank you on behalf of EFRAG for allowing us to put forward our views. And just for public order, EFRAG has published its draft comment letter, which was published on the 31st of May, and that's open for public comment up until the 11th of July. We felt that the document that you put forward was excellent. It was comprehensive and absolute moves in the right direction. However, if you give a document of this ilk to a group of technical accountants, you'll get a lot of comment and a lot of detailed stuff. And that will be included in the letter, but what I want to do today is highlight just a few items which are of major importance. And again, I'm actually going to highlight particularly process and mission, if I may. Bob, in your introductory comments, you talked about the importance of enhancing the process, and in particular the role of the DPOC, and we very much appreciate the direction moving there. And in particular, I'd like to highlight that you reflect also on the very beginning of the process of formulating these standards, which is a conceptual framework. And there's a big body of opinion in EFRAG that needs strengthening. And they feel that no fundamental change of principle should be made prior to a genuine conceptual debate taking place. And EFRAG feels that revisions to accounting standards have been introduced without proper consultation. And the most obvious of those, perhaps, is fair value changes that were made. And I can go into details of those if you wish later on. Besides consultation, there's consistency, which is an item raised by a number of people today and at previous issues. What we'd suggest is that in order to have consistency with the process, the DPOC will have to ensure that there's a great deal of substance behind that process and ensure that there is genuine justification for changes when changes are being made to standards, and also opportunity to harmonise. We felt, for example, there was an opportunity missed with the introduction of IFRS 9 to unify it with the best parts of IAS 39. Moving on, the next comment, if I can turn my page. Taxonomy, which is something I'm surprised hasn't been raised to date yet. I'm sure other people will raise it. We have great concerns about incorporation of the reporting format into accounting standards. The incorporation of XBRL may lead to decisions on standards being made on the basis of ease of reporting as opposed to what is the correct decision for the standard itself. And we feel it could contradict, perhaps, or at least conflict with sound principles. Moving on to mission, a few things here. Firstly, absolutely, we endorse the focus on adoption rather than convergence. Convergence is no longer sustainable as a driving objective. Secondly, for the purpose of financial reporting, we would emphasise that the importance of long-term investors. Because at the end of the day, we are there to support the development of capital markets, and sound economic growth and long-term sustainable wealth creation is better achieved with a long-term focus. So we think there should be a long-term element as an essential component of your trustee vision and strategy. And finally, the danger of creep. We all suffer from mission creep. We have some concerns about defining the boundaries of financial statements. There's a growing scope of disclosures, not least of which, importantly, on risk management and risk strategies. This could cause a lack of focus and cause particularly a delay in release of notes to accounts, which are increasingly released after the primary accounts anyway. So can we please pay also at least one eye of attention to mission creep? And finally, on governance, we welcome the reviews on governance. We don't think the monitoring board governance actually reflects itself and its own governance appropriately. There was an item in your statement here whereby we say elements of the governance process should be transparent. We'd like to add the word all in front of that, all elements. At the end of the day, proper accountability of the board rests with the most senior board in the whole process. And transparent oversight of that, we feel, is of great importance. We don't want to avoid cronyism or whatever else could erupt otherwise. And finally, a comment to echo what's just been made, actually. We feel life has moved on, and instead of having the bilateral discussions with national standard setters, as has often been the case in the past, much more use can be made of regional organisations. EFRAG is clearly one of those. I believe the Latin American one is due for establishment in about a week's time. Africa, Asia. It has two benefits. It gives a much greater scope of engagement across the world, but also if you have group engagement in this way, it's a much more powerful form of engagement than bilateral conversations. So thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Let me just make a couple of responses and then ask you a question. on your last point, we do talk about local standard setters and other organizations, and I think we do indeed respect the role of regional organizations like your own. Other people have commented on XBRL, and their comments have been perhaps summarized as being careful not to let the tail wag the dog, and I suspect that that's the same comment as you're suggesting. On the due process committee, and its need to deal with substance. I think the trustees recognize that, and indeed that's why they have said it will be supported by a technical staff, because frankly the trustees don't have, or in many cases don't have, certainly in my case don't have the technical competence to do that, but it will be supported by a technical staff recognizing that in order to do its process oversight, it really does need access to technical understanding. The question I wanted to ask you about was your comment on long-term investors. Do you see places where the standards that the board would set would be different if it were taking particularly the perspective of a long-term investor versus, I suppose, by comparison, a short-term investor? Would that lead to different accounting standards, do you think?
Difficult question to answer. Let me give you two components to the answer. First one is a digression, if I may, but what we're really focusing on in my comments is what you're going to implement in the future to ensure that long-term is at the basis of your thinking. In terms of the accounting standards itself, the one that will always come into focus in relation to long-term is fair value accounting, the appropriateness of it. If you take, for example, retirement schemes, or in the UK, books of annuity, that's fixed annuities rather than anything else, the requirement to mark to market on an annual basis can at least be heavily debated by a wide range of stakeholders. And it's difficult to disagree with the fact that that has had some impact on what has been a rather devastating decline in final salary schemes. Plenty of other things have had a big impact on that as well. But I think there are some areas, and I've had a long debate with Ian on this one at the County Standards Board, about the appropriate discount rate, for example. I do believe full stakeholder interest and long-term views should be taken on some of those matters.
Thank you very much.
Could I ask a question? Do you similarly distinguish between long-term fixed income investors, long-term equity investors? Do you distinguish when you look at a short-term investor, is there a value judgment in your statement that short-term investing is less beneficial to society than long-term investing? Not that, I mean, the trustees have frankly decided that as we look at this issue, it's one that's a very difficult value judgment to make. So transparency has been the objective. I'm just curious where you come from.
Several components to that. The first on the time frame. You could say that equity investors are going to have a much longer duration than a fixed income investor. Equity ought to be viewed as perpetual, really. It's certainly very long term. In fixed income, the time frame is considerably shorter. But on most definitions of long term, they all come into the long term cap. So we'll probably end up splitting hairs on that one. Overall, I think the concern is that we've had, certainly as a professional investment manager, I've been serially beaten up by every authority, particularly the UK government, about short-termism. And at my last company, which I ran, we're the largest provider of index tracking funds throughout the UK and, in fact, in Europe. And there you do have, arguably, the longest-term time frame. So I find it rather ironic to be beaten up about short-term trading strategies for that. But it is clear that if we want a long, sustainable growth in the world, you have to take a long-term view, whether it's about sustainability or just about growth. If you want to minimize capital costs, you probably, again, should take the longer-term view. So we would suggest that you build the long-term view in your core, because that is what investing is all about. There's nothing wrong with some of these short-term strategies. One of the joys I've had is when I've been questioned, particularly by, for example, the Treasury Select Committee about engagement and whether investors have been absentee landlords, so to speak, of companies. I asked them how much engagement they would really like from short sellers. It's clearly going to be diametrically opposed, because they really want companies to go bust. So I think that if you take the full gamut of investing approaches, you're going to cover everything under the sun. But if you focus on the long term, you're going to serve the broadest church possible of the people using IFRS for appropriate purposes.
Yeah, and from a value perspective, I am in exactly the same place as you are in terms of long term. I lead an effort by both the World Economic Forum and the Aspen Institute around the ways to discourage short termism. The difficulty that I'm struggling with is transparency for short term less valuable than transparency for long-term? Is transparency for fixed income on a 10-year duration different than transparency for an equity investment? And that's, I think, where Bob's question was. I was trying to understand, is transparency good or bad? Is it ever good or bad? is where I'm trying to understand.
Well, I think transparency is always going to be good, but there is a difference between transparency and clarity. And what we really want to focus on in most areas is actually clarity, particularly on the accounting standards themselves. There's quite a good debate about equity and fixed income investors and their engagement and their use of IFRS. If I was to overgeneralize, and please forgive me for this, the equity investors primarily focus on the P&L side of the equation and fixed income on the balance sheet. And therefore, to me, they both add a great deal process. And I've always found engagement much stronger when you involve both components overall. But we must recognize at the end of the day, a lot of fixed income investors are going to be looking at the various covenants included in the nature of their bond and actually investing in a specific instrument rather than acting as owners of the overall capital. So I think at the end of the day, the equity and straight ownership view is more relevant to the long-term growth in the economy.
Thank you very much. Will?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank you for having the opportunity to share this, share views and have this discussion. Ernst & Young is busy preparing its draft, its comment letter, so what I express is our tentative views, and the full details will be in our final, in our full letter. When we compare the report to our February 11 comment letter, we recognize a lot of what we wrote in our letter, so I could stop here and say it's a great report, but of course, as Peter said, if you give this to a worldwide organization, you will get comments. So I'll focus on a few points where I would see them as more like clarifications rather than real strong opposition. The first one is we fully support what I would call the protection of the IFRS brand. So the use of IFRS or deviations from IFRS should be clear to the user what's going on here. What we'd like to stress is, and here's where the trustees may help, is whose responsibility would it be to clarify that? And our concern is that that this will be on the individual entities plate to solve the problem, whereas we think it's more an issue of the IFRS Foundation as whole, together with national regulators, to sort these things out. What we'd like to avoid is, because we don't think it's efficient, that each individual registrant would then have to explain where it deviates from full IFRS. The other thing is we support trustees' focus on the private sector entities. We think that's a wise choice to make, and we agree that if there's gaps in just policy concerns, that those can be closed by supplementary disclosures. What we'd like to stress is that that should be an excuse for having all sorts of disclosures, because there's all sorts of needs from all sorts of users. So that the key should be what is relevant to the investor and other market participants. We share the concerns about local interpretations. They should be discouraged, and I think there's a role to play here for not just the monitoring board, but potentially also the IFRIC. Maybe more use can be made of IFRIC in terms of avoiding that to happen, and certainly about also the clarity on the and retrievability of what IFRIC decides. So that's about mission. On governance, we support the three-tier structure. We hope somehow the monitoring board and the trustees can agree on, for example, a date to issue their report, so that at least, although we understand there's not going to be one report, but at least make it a coordinated effort so that we get a single view from the whole organization. A few things on process. It's been mentioned before, but I'd like to stress the importance of field testing, adequate field testing, and also to manage expectations about what field testing means. We've heard several interpretations of what field testing means, and it could range from having one-hour discussion with the CFO to doing really getting dirty and doing the debits and the credits. And we feel that for major projects, you have to get down to details, you know, to call it field testing. Otherwise, you can't really tell what the impact of your stance is going to be. A small point, but it's what we found during a couple of exposure drafts that the consequential amendments to other stands were not included. And we find it difficult to respond to a proposal if we don't see the full picture. Now, sometimes it's just editorial, which is fine, but sometimes it's significant change to understand it, that's, that you want to have to understand that the consequences. I think those were some highlights, Bob. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, and we'll have a chance to go back in more detail when we run the various questions. Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate the opportunity to participate. I want to commend the foundation for the handling of their oversight responsibilities. I want to make comments in three specific areas, if I can. The first one I'd like to talk about is due process. I want to say I strongly support the recommendation in paragraph C3 of the establishment of a working group to develop an agreed-upon methodology for field testing. And picking up on Leo's comments, is I think it's field testing is very important. Based on my experience, field visits are a poor substitute for field testing. One thing I'd like to suggest is, besides looking at field testing for preparers, is maybe a thought process about field testing for investors. And I'd like to say I'm part of the ISB's Global Preparers Forum, and we're meeting this afternoon with the board and also the Capital Markets Advisory Council. So it'll be a group of preparers and investors that are together talking about the proposed disclosures on the leasing document and the revenue recognition document. And based on my experience, there's not enough meetings that have preparers interacting with users on a one-to-one basis to actually debate and discuss different proposals and different disclosures. And I'm really looking forward to the meeting this afternoon, as I think that'll be a robust feedback to the board. And so when looking at field testing, if there could be interaction between investors and users in that process, I think between preparers and investors, I think it would be a great idea if you can look at that. My remaining two comments have to do with the mission section. I want to say I strongly agree with what's in paragraph on A1, that the standard should serve investors and other market participants in their economic and resource allocation decisions. I agree with the next statement, but I do get a little concerned. Just want to share my concern with you. The statement's made that the ISB should develop financial reporting standards that provide a faithful presentation of an entity's financial position and performance. And I just want to comment there that while I agree with it, we need to be careful that we don't focus on financial reporting as a looking back proposition, of looking back at what has happened in the past. And I think we constantly need to work about what information can we provide to investors to help them to make forecasts of what future performance would be. I think Sam had touched on it a little bit with his interaction and again, what he did at the firm with PricewaterhouseCoopers and value reporting, enhanced business reporting, integrated reporting. Strongly support a research capacity at the IASB to look at these future-oriented type items of increasing the content of disclosures that are going to investors, and maybe get a forward-looking focus if we can, and not as much reliance on the backward-looking focus. The last comment I wanted to make has to do with paragraph A5, and is really on the consistency of application and implementation. And I believe this is going to be critical. Other people have talked about it. One of the recommendations is that the ISB work with a network of security regulators, audit regulators, standard setters, and other stakeholders to identify divergence in practice. And I strongly agree with that recommendation. One concern I have is, does the IASB have the bandwidth to actually do that? And I would like to see more work and maybe more specifics on what the trustees think about going about that and the use of the monitoring board and international regulators, because I think that is going to be a key aspect of having one set of global standards. And I get concerned about the IASB's bandwidth to participate in that, and I think they're going to need some assistance with that. Again, I really appreciate the opportunity to participate and look forward to our discussions.
Let me return, and thank you very much, and let me return to your last point, because you quite correctly state that we are much concerned about the consistency in application and reaching for mechanisms that will allow us to secure it more. Are there other things we could do? I mean, you raised the issue of whether the ISB will have the bandwidth to deal with this. We clearly are putting a great deal of responsibility or emphasis on local standard setters and local regulatory agencies to help us. Are there other things that we should be doing?
I think there needs to be in my opinion, I think there needs to be some thought process about some sort of infrastructure, and I'm not thinking about a large infrastructure, but an infrastructure to actually go out and look at where there's belief that they're not being applied consistently, and that it will be a difficult job. And I believe IOSCO can help in that, and different bodies like that. I think the National Standard Centers can play a key role in that, and it's been talked about the auditing firms and even companies where they see one of their competitors or other companies that they're looking at, and maybe a divergence in application. But I do believe that there needs to be some resources there. There needs to be some sort of infrastructure because it's such an important part of the process.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Once again, I would say thank you for inviting me and ESMA to come and present our views on this. We are supportive of a lot of things that have been said already. I would like to sort of just say a few things about ESMA before I start, and then I will concentrate on three areas that we think are of particular importance to us and to you moving forward. Obviously, ESMA, one of its chief objectives is to ensure coordination between securities regulators in Europe. And also we have a key role in advising the Commission on legislation in Europe. And we have also a key objective of market stability as one of our objectives to achieve in the regulatory activities that we have. And we also, as I say, have responsibilities for direct regulatory intervention in some markets in Europe in certain circumstances. Part of our big issue with regards to IFRS is always is consistency of application across European markets, and that extends to markets globally to the effect that we can influence such things. One of the key elements that we try to do in trying to implement that consistency are our enforcement coordination sessions, where we get together all European enforcers of IFRS and discuss issues to do with implementation. And picking up on Bob's comment, we offer that experience to the ISB and to the trustees to discuss issues with IFRS. We are very keen to expand our coordination with the monitoring board, with the trustees, and with the ISB generally to help ensure that consistent application across Europe. We welcome your discussion paper and believe that in general the issues that it raises are on the right track, and we would help support how you move forward on this. The three issues that I would like to raise from our perspective, we too, and we acknowledge that everybody involved in the process has made great steps over the past few years. We recognize a lot of improvement in the interaction with the markets that have taken place over at least the last 4 or 5 years. We think that the focus should be continuing to improve the due process. We would like to see sort of evidence of monitoring of that due process and ensuring its improvement. More upfront analysis and definition when setting the agenda, for instance, of what the objectives will be in changing standards, and more sort of monitoring of how that upfront definition is actually achieved. Our second point is that we believe that the trustees should be more active in enhancing that due process oversight activity. You should observe the deliberations of the ISB, ensure that the ISB has applied that due process, improve communication with stakeholders. That would include post-implementation reviews, field analysis, all of those sorts of things. Again, we acknowledge that that improvements have taken place, but we believe that you can go further in all of this. And my final point is that we do believe that one of the key elements that needs to be developed in this strategy review is developing the role of the IFRS Interpretations Committee. We believe that there should be more steps or greater steps made to ensure its independence, particularly the audit profession. And we believe that more thought needs to be sort of given to how to prepare it for its role with more jurisdictions, as more jurisdictions come on board to use IFRS. I think I'll stop there, and any other comments we'll make are sort of on specific aspects.
Just returning to your comments on due process, I think the trustees are certainly in agreement with you and indeed try to reflect that in the paper. Again, we are calling for review of due process throughout the standard-setting process, end to end, and not just at the end. And we say further, report regularly to the trustees and in an end. So, again, I think we certainly support your notions of transparency and reporting on that issue. We can perhaps come back to some of the more details later. Thank you very much.
Bob, could I just ask you a question?
Of course.
The Interpretations Committee independence issue is could you expand on what your concern is there, that your specific reference to the audit firms?
Our rightly or wrongly, our experience with IFRIC is very much that, and it's perhaps inevitable that the audit firms who, like ourselves as enforcers, are concerned with how IFRS is interpreted, are the ones who come up with the issues to be brought to the IFRIC, and I suppose discussions of those issues moving forward. But we just have a sort of concern that it needs to move away and perhaps expand its stakeholder base, perhaps, is the way to describe it, to make it more effective as more jurisdictions come on board in the future.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a number of questions about its level of engagement, where it spends its time, should it be issuing more interpretations. We've heard that at several of these, but you're the first one that raised the question of independence. And if I hear you, The independence that you are concerned with is more on the fact that the input into the Interpretations Committee is often concentrated from a few sources. You're not suggesting that the Interpretations Committee is not independent in its deliberation, or are you, in fact, doing that as well?
There is a possibility that a large amount of the sort of reflections and technical input to that committee is driven by audit firms.
Well, we should check that. Thank you.
On due process, just a comment for later discussion, I think. One thing we recommend that's relatively new is a post-implementation due process, looking back and seeing how it's working in terms of... Is that something you all would favor? Should we put much more effort there?
I mean, we welcome the fact that I think IFRS 8 is due to have the first implementation review next year. Just as a matter of interest, again, ESMA is itself looking at the implementation of IFRS 8 in the context of the report that needs to be made by the Commission to the European Council and Parliament at the end of this year. So, yes, certainly from our perspective, the more of this sort of post-implementation review, the more of this sort of feedback that type of experience gets into the standard-setting process, the better, as far as we're concerned.
Very good. Veronica?
Thank you. Let me start by saying that Deloitte very much welcomes the opportunity to participate in these roundtables and commends the IFRS Foundation trustees for the openness, thoroughness, and timeliness of their strategy review. There are three points that I would like to comment on today, and I will be echoing some of the earlier comments. Well, first, I think it is absolutely vital that the governance structure achieves a proper balance between accountability, oversight, legitimacy on one hand, and the independence of the ISB on the other. We continue to support the current three-tier structure, and we believe that within the three-tier structure, the monitoring board should provide the political legitimacy to the standard-setting process and should act as a link to national governments. The IFRS Foundation trustees should oversee the day-to-day activities of the ISB. They should promote transparency of the organization, and they should act as a buffer between the standard setter protecting and the politicians, ultimately protecting the standard setter from political interference and the interests of the day. The ISB should very much act as an independent standard setter and should operate within a clearly defined and documented system of due process. The ISB should be fully accountable to the trustees. We see the three tiers as one structure, And I think that's the important point we would like to make. We see it as one structure. And as such, we urge the trustees to acknowledge and articulate how the monitoring board fits into the structure and how it has a vital role to play in the delivery of high-quality financial reporting. In particular, it has a role in facilitating the incorporation of IFRS into the financial reporting systems of jurisdictions worldwide. And we see it very much as the role of the monitoring board to act on incidents where jurisdictions are assessing compliance with IFRS without incorporating IFRS fully into their financial reporting structure. This is important if we are to get high quality, consistent application of IFRS internationally. In addition, the monitoring board has an important role to play in helping the IFRS Foundation to achieve its funding goal, and so that the foundation is able then to operate effectively and independently. My second point is to encourage the trustees to establish a clear vision of how best to leverage the skills and experience of those with expertise in financial reporting around the world. So in particular, references have already been made to the national standard setters and regional standard setters. These groups of standard setters have knowledge, skills, and experience that can be and should be utilized in the IFRS standard setting process. There is a huge amount of interest, experience, and goodwill that is waiting to be tapped there. These resources could be used to gather empirical evidence, conduct effect studies, and post-implementation reviews that references have been made to. We encourage the trustees to put formal working arrangements in place around the relationships between the ISB and those regional and national standard setters. This should contribute to truly global financial reporting standards and reduce the perceived intellectual isolation of the ISB. And then finally, robust governance structure around IFRS is critical to achieving the G20's goal of one set of high-quality global financial reporting standards. And we see the report very much through that lens. So, consequently, the trustees' efforts should be coordinated with the efforts of the monitoring board so that the constituents can see a cohesive set of governance reforms. We remain concerned that, at present, the two reviews continue to appear to be out of step. I'd be happy to elaborate further on the points I have just made.
On that last point, I hope the comments today will give you some further assurance that, in fact, those two reviews are being conducted in a most coordinated way, cooperative way. Because I agree with you, it's most important we do that. We've had and continue to have a very fine working relationship with the monitoring board, and I think on both sides realize that this has to be done in a way that is coordinated and cooperative, or it could lead to very, very unfortunate results. And as I say, I hope the comments you've heard today, as have been expressed by the monitoring board representative at the other roundtables, will give you some reassurance of the coordinated fashion in which this is going forward.
They do. They do, and we're very much looking forward to the joint proposals later in the year whereby the two come together.
Thank you very much. As with others, we'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in today's discussion and also congratulate you on the document that's been produced. As others have indicated, we saw certain themes come from our comment letter and appear in that document, so that's quite pleasing for us as an organisation. So while we agree with much of what's in the document, I also have to justify my existence, so I have some comments. But it's more emphasis on certain points than disagreement with them. Just picking up on the point that's just been touched on, like others, we were concerned at the lack of joined-up approach of the two consultations when these were started. We're perhaps not quite where we'd like to be yet, but we do welcome the improvements that have been made, and we also look forward to the joint proposals later in the year. So it is something that we would mention as an organisation as well. If I look at the structure, we too agree with the three-tier structure. And one of the things that the Monitoring Board does give and is essential is the degree of public accountability. And that takes you into the governments. And we believe that's a critical feature, and without it, you don't have that accountability, and it's essential that you do. Having said that, there's always going to be the tension of just how far does the Monitoring Board come into the operations of what you do. We would very much be against that. There is a little bit of a move in at the moment with the approval of the trustees. We wouldn't want to see it going any further than that. Moving on a little bit onto the points in adoption of IFRS and the consistency of application, these are linked, so I really want to deal with those together. But if I do the first subset, which is the adoption, if you look around the various jurisdictions that we have, you've got full adoption of IFRS, partial adoption. IFRS is drawn from particular dates. In fact, there's one country that apparently uses the 1999 book. So there's a wide range, and the danger that that brings with it is risk to the IFRS brand. And while you could say this perhaps isn't something directly for the IFRS Foundation, I believe it does have to have an interest in it. The question then, of course, is what do you do about it? And it seems to be something where the liaison with the securities regulators, with the National Standards Service and other organizations is going to be critical in identifying where these gaps are. Some might go as far as to say you should have something which shows which countries are where, possibly on your website. I'm not sure I'd go that far because I'm not really convinced that's your job. But it's certainly something where it's a growing issue and not everyone is moving on to the current standards. On consistency of application, this is a similar thing. You could say, well, we're a standard setter, so it's not quite our job, but clearly it's a brand risk. Again, I see a very strong role for the national standard setters and securities regulators. It's a recurring theme of national standard setters, which I do want to touch on at the end as well. There is, however, the question of what do you do with the IFRIC in this? And I would just note that the IFRIC is under review at the moment, and it would be important to link the IFRIC into what you might do with those other global organizations in identifying issues and then dealing with them. On due process, just a couple of points. On XBRL, so I'll be the second one today, there's quite a lot of coverage in your paper, and we would just be a little bit concerned about the point that was raised of the tail wagging the dog. We're very much of the view that you develop the standards, and if XBRL wants to come along behind so that you're ready for it, that's fine, but we wouldn't want to see the standards driven by XBRL itself. On due process itself, while we do very much welcome the enhancements that are being brought in and proposed, I think we'd also note the very substantial improvements that have been made in recent years on due process. And sometimes the Foundation perhaps doesn't articulate that to the outside world as clearly as it might. And so we would rather encourage you to look at what's already been achieved as well as what you're going to do going forwards, because I think there's a lot of progress being made. On the research function, I'm not sure I'd see that as a priority for the ISB, but I would look at using other organizations again. And that takes me back a little bit to the national standard setters, because as more and more organizations or jurisdictions come into IFRS and nothing else, the question is, what's the role of a national standard setter? And it seems to me that what the national standard setter would become very much is the international liaison link that you've got. Your alternative is to set up branches in every country, and I don't think you'd want to do that. And so there's a very powerful role that I believe national standard setters can play. But it's important that that is brought into play so that these national standard setters don't have the risk of withering, because there is the perceived risk of that. And that then links into the funding point, because jurisdictions are going to be asked to fund the IFRS Foundation. The risk of that is that money gets taken away from their national standard groups and comes to the ISB instead. And that's a danger I would imagine you would want to avoid if you possibly could. In terms of how the funding comes in, I think your GDP link seems a sensible way to do it. There was a little discussion at the Advisory Council yesterday as well, and do you do purchasing power adjusted GDP? You could do that. But this is an area where I'd also see the monitoring board having a role in ensuring that you get the stable funding mechanism set up, which is one of the most critical things that you need to deal with at the moment. Just one overall point to finish with. The document that you've got, as I said, is very welcome, and the content is very good. One of the things that perhaps isn't done quite so much is that it rather takes you from where you are now to where we're going. The one part that you might think about a little bit more is not so much where we are now, because the organization's not where we necessarily expected it to be. So might you have a look at where you'd like to be now and see where the gaps are. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. On the role of national standard setters, I mean, I understand the thrust of your argument that they are an immense resource. You want to make sure they are preserved as a resource, and the question is how best to use them. In terms of their roles, that will, as I understand it, differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In some jurisdictions, they will clearly have a very active role. In jurisdictions where they have used incorporation, they actually are the incorporating body, and so they have a very real ongoing role. So it will necessarily differ, but I take the thrust of it, your argument is that they are a very important resource, and we should think about how best to use that resource, and there are a number of ways to use it.
Yes, I agree. It's in a slightly different way. It's a bit like funding question, how do you collect it? It depends which jurisdiction you're in. You might do it slightly differently. It's similar that the NSSs might have a slightly different approach or role. It depends on where you're coming from.
I think that's right. I mean, the paper just put out by the U.S. SEC, use the National Standard Center as having an ongoing role as the incorporating body, or incorporating individual standards as issued by the ISB into U.S. Standards. So, other comments, questions? Very good. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for the opportunity to address the meeting. Our comments are in the draft stage at present at G100, but I'm confident that we will be very supportive of the view of the review and the general direction that the trustees are taking. A comment first on governance. We support the three tiers that have been set up, and the strategic reviews, however, have suggested some changes to the current process that very much challenged our understanding of the roles. So we have responded to those areas where we felt a little challenged, and we're keen to see the respective roles clarified. But the overall intent of the three tiers we do support. My remaining comments refer to processes. We encourage the development of a disclosure framework. The G100 published a booklet last year called Less is More, which aimed to do some initial thinking on some principles and criteria that would guide not companies in disclosure, but rather standard setters in writing standards when they came to develop the disclosure part of the standard. We see the disclosure overload as one of the problems at the moment for everyone, preparers and investors alike, because investors tend not to read all the disclosures but rather rely on the corporates to pull out the relevant bits because of the size of the disclosure documents. So we would like to see the disclosure framework progressed. There's been a few people mention the issue of branding and the concerns that have been around for a very long time about countries and jurisdictions that partially adopt IFRS, maybe 99%, maybe 95%. Now, Australia, I don't think, did a very good job initially of ensuring that the world understood that we had adopted IFRS. And I take my share of responsibility for this. I was on the AASB at the time. We thought it was crystal clear to everyone that we had adopted IFRS. So I'll take the downside. I will also take the upside because as a member of the AASB, I fought long and hard to ensure that not a single word was changed when we adopted, other than the two permitted bits, to remove an option or to add disclosure, both of which are permitted. But we didn't do a good job at letting the world know that we had adopted IFRS. The problem continues to plague jurisdictions, whether they're fully adopting, carving out, using an older version or whatever. I have a slightly different view from Andrew here. I do think it is the role of the Foundation and the IASB to clarify this in a very factual and non-judgmental way. I think it would assist a lot of the rumours that float round about who hasn't adopted and who has and how far they've adopted if the IASB had a very simple page on its website that provided the legal status of the adoption in those countries that claim they have adopted. That the description that is put up or the words that are put up could be agreed as appropriate with the legislators or the national standard setters. But I think that would go a long way to both protecting the brand of the IASB and dispelling many of the misinformation that circulates around the world. And having been the subject of that misinformation, I can understand how easily it can arise. Moving on to cost-benefit, which has been mentioned by a few people in different guises, as a prepare organisation, G100 is very keen to see work done on cost-benefit and effects analysis. The earlier that can be done in the process, the better, and the comment has been made that the ISB needs to be very clear on what it's trying to achieve before it starts a project. We would, of course, encourage that. We have to do a cost-benefit in Australia for each standard, so we do have some experience of doing that. And the final thing that we will mention in our comment letter is the role and relevance of dissenting views. When standards are issued now, there is a lot of time spent on the basis of conclusions, and the basis of conclusion goes into the views that have not been supported in the final standard, and explains why they have not been supported. In addition, the deliberations of the IASB are available on the web, so the world can see which members of the IASB have had a different view along the way. But we have a view that publishing a dissenting view actually prejudices the cohesion of the board in getting behind the final standard. In other words, board members will have their own individual views as the standard is developed. Those are well known and well publicised. We think when the final standard is issued, the board should all say, as a group, we support the final standard. If you're going to play a game, you have to abide by the final rules, even if you disagree. So our submission will comment on the relevance of dissenting views. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a little more than 35 minutes. To talk about the individual pieces. I'm going to try and keep us moving forward so that we get through all the parts.
I wonder if I could just make some general comments.
Of course you may.
Before we get into. Thank you very much. Just from the point of view of the ISB, these discussions are always interesting and there's always something new comes up and it's good to hear. Just on a few topics that have been discussed, research. There seems to be a general agreement we should have a research function of some sort. There's different views on how big it should be and how extensive. I personally agree with the view that we should reach out and that we should be using existing research facilities, wherever they are, be they professional bodies, standard setters, academic, whatever. I think that our strategy should be to reach out, and we'll need to look into that. And I don't think it is the goal to have a very large and extensive research facility within this building. There was a point raised by Peter on a project for smaller companies. Peter, we've got our agenda setting consultation coming out next month. Please be sure to get your suggestions into that. People have mentioned the conceptual framework. There has been a lot of support all around the place. The work on the conceptual framework's been held up for the last 3 or 4 years for obvious reasons, because there's been a concentration on convergence. Most people seem to agree we should get back onto it. My only advice, and I fully agree with that, and I hope to be strongly personally involved with that project as it goes forward. But be careful, it's not the Holy Grail. It's not going to solve all our standard setting problems. We should have a conceptual framework. We should abide by it. And if we don't, we should be explicit as to why we're not. But it's not going to give us consistency immediately across standards, etc. The taxonomy and XBRL, I've listened with interest because I personally have confusion in my mind as to how we're going to merge those two and what the process should be. So I would urge people, if you have knowledge or experience in this area, to please avail us of it, because we need to think about that. Regional bodies and national standard setters. Take Peter's point that there are now developing a number of regional bodies. In fact, we'll almost cover the world, you know, very shortly. And of course, if regions can get together, they're stronger. But we have to balance that against individual countries' needs as well, and the regions won't always agree amongst themselves. So it would be my personal view, we should work strongly with both and balance it. And we're hoping to get a memorandum of understanding with national standard setters and regional bodies this year. I know the national standard setters themselves are working on it. We're working on it this end. Hopefully we can get together. Bob made the very legitimate point that different national standard setters will have different roles going ahead. A lot of them do have a kind of an adoption, are part of the adoption process already. But on that SEC document, I actually, apart from the adoption bit, which might vary, the rest of the list of what they said national standard setters could do, I thought was a very good, you know, almost a checklist of how you could use them and what role they could play. And they did that, of course, by reaching out around the world and doing good research. Due process. Everybody wants more extensive due process. Everybody wants more oversight. Everybody wants us to do it more often. At the end of the day, we do have to get on and set some standards. And so there's got to be a limit somewhere. EFRAG, for instance, have produced, I think, a very good document on effect analysis, which stresses the notion of doing this from start to end. And I think that's becoming fairly common currency, and there's general agreement on that, and I would certainly have no problems. And we're looking to work with that document and any other documents that are about to try and get the most effective due process. Field testing, post-implementation reviews, of course, it's like apple pie and motherhood and apple pie. Again, you've got to be careful. You can go on field testing forever. Post-implementation reviews, you've got to manage expectations. Do you want us to be changing the standards every 3 years? We get out and have a look. Do you want complete revision? Do we want to change the basis of IFRS 8 next year, or do we want a period of calm? Or so we've got to manage expectation. IFRIC review, somebody made the point, is underway, and I think it does meld in a little bit with this study as well, and we should be looking. And Judith, the disclosure framework, that's been mentioned for a while. I think that, again, should be part of our agenda-setting consultation. And, you know, if you feel strongly on it, I'd urge you to be encouraging us through that way.
Thank you, Bob. All right. Let me turn to the individual questions that we consider. The first two deal with recommendations A1, A2, and A3. And the first, that in our mission, it is faithful presentation of financial position performance for the use of investors and others making market-based economic and resource allocation decisions. And this recommendations 2 and 3 basically deal with full adoption rather than just simply convergence. My sense is that there seem to be, from your comments, strong support for both the way we express it and for those. And if so, if that's the case, then let me move on and ask you, with regards to question 3, our emphasis is on private sector, and at least for now, standards for private sector entities. Is that something that leaves you comfortable?
I think that it is in the public interest that the trustees and the ISB explore very soon the desirability and the feasibility of addressing accounting by the not-for-profit sector. I do understand that this may not be for some time because of resource constraints, and that's perfectly valid, but I think an early indication from ISB of what its intentions are in this area might be helpful. There is a gap here. There isn't such a gap in relation to public sector accounting. The work of IPSASB has been important in contributing to public sector accounting and promoting standards closely aligned to IFRS, but I'm not aware of similar endeavours with the not-for-profit sector. So I think some early exploration there would be something that we'd support.
Certainly, the word I would emphasise we say for now, and we do frame this in terms of our resources and our capacity to do things. A5, Q, fourth question, really does deal with this question that many of you commented on how we achieve consistent application. It is the view, obviously, of the trustees that this is both from the point of view of the brand and to give meaning to the notion of globally accepted accounting standards. It's only a single standard if it is consistently applied. And so this is of great importance. We do highlight the importance of regulators and standard setters, and I would say both local and regional regulators and standard setters. In that activity, are there other things we should be saying there? Some people mentioned the monitoring board, the role of the monitoring board in helping accomplish this. I take note of that. Are there other things that we should be seeing there and thinking? All right. Then let me move us on to governance. And here it's clear. I mean, what we say is the independence of the standard setting process within a framework of public accountability is crucial. And then go on to say we believe that the three-tier structure of the governance, we think, is the best way of accomplishing these purposes. Jeff, you mentioned in your comments the important role of the trustees in assuring the independence of the process and of the board, and I take note of that. I mean, it's clearly the focus and purpose of the trustees to accomplish that, and perhaps I take note that that's a point we might make explicitly.
Yeah, as I indicated, I think it's a very key function of the trustees and in all the other responsibilities that you have, and they seem to continue to increase. You have to really focus on what the key functions are, and that is certainly at the top of the list in my mind.
Okay, I take your point. Other comments on the governance structure? Yes.
Yeah. Well, we agree with what's in B. The thing you might also want to add is visibility. So it's not just clarification of what your role is, but also the visibility of what's been done. I mean, there is a perception out there that although a lot of work has probably been done, it wasn't as visible as people might want to see.
Very good. Thank you.
It was particularly true of due process. Somebody mentioned earlier that we just haven't indicated how dramatic the changes have been and how much it's being done.
But it's not just due process. The trustee has a wider role to play, and it's the total role of the trustees.
Andrew had made an observation again on governance that one that we are sensitive to, and that's clarity as to the roles. And I think you used the word that the monitoring board had begun to their engagement in trustee approval. Sounded as if you were concerned in that space that maybe they were exceeding original intent. I wasn't sure if that's what you were saying.
Not quite.
Because it is the role of the monitoring board explicitly is to approve the trustees.
Absolutely, and that wasn't quite the point, so I'm sorry if I wasn't quite clear on it. I absolutely acknowledge that that's part of the monitoring board's role, and that it's quite proper for it to be involved in that way. It was more, and perhaps this reflects some of the original thoughts that were in the monitoring board's documents, that we wouldn't like to see the monitoring board moving further into the direct operations of the foundation.
Yeah.
We view it very much as doing what the name says of monitoring, and if requested, providing advice, but not going any further than that. So that was the point.
I think that's one that we would all be very sympathetic with. There was some concern we've heard at a few of the roundtables that raising, just generally talking about, should the monitoring board be more involved in this, should they be more involved in that, should the trustees be more involved in certain issues. I think, Lee, you may have mentioned direct observation of deliberation. We've put a lot of that dialogue into the strategy review just to explore the boundaries in the right place. And so I don't want anyone to think that the dialogue does not suggest that we are in favor of changing the boundary, but we want to be sure we have the boundary where the monitoring board starts and stops, where the trustees start and stop. So, and in that regard, Lee, I mean, I think that your suggestion around observation of deliberation, the trustees and the entire due process oversight committee looks at each of those steps, where we should be touching and where we should not. And there's an equal requirement that we provide oversight with an equal requirement that we do not impair independence. So we're very careful about how far you go into that process. Our job is not to interfere with the deliberation. Our job is to make sure deliberation is thorough and the due process is followed, but to try not to be too visible or even engaged in the process itself, because that's not our job.
You shouldn't be setting the standards. That's too far.
That's the key. As yeah. Bob said, technical skill may not be widely dispersed.
It can all create a smile on our face, but we're also very careful that we do not interfere with the direction of standards from a technical perspective. We might ask the question, and Peter, to your point, we might ask the question, do we really understand the unintended consequence of this standard? But we would not want to say, we think the unintended consequence is X and you need to change that standard. That goes one step too far. But if we don't like where the board is going, they certainly will get a sense that we're questioning, have they done their homework? But it's their job to put the answer on the page, not ours. So, you know, as your comment, Lee, I just want to be sure that if you thought we were in the wrong place, I really would want to hear that.
No, it's making sure that the process, the due process, is articulated up front, that thought goes into what that process should be, and the market is clear on it, and that it is followed up, and that you're seen to be making sure that true process is kept to. I think that is sort of encapsulating where we're coming from.
Can I just ask Lee this? I thought were indicating, not of course that the trustees would attempt to have a view on the technical standards, as Sam has explained, but I think you were saying that in order for the due process to be fully effective, there should be direct observation, not necessarily participation, but actually seeing. Could you help me to understand the incremental benefits in due process that would bring, given that the trustees are not technically proficient, and after 2 days, 2 hours, they probably go brain dead, let alone a week of the board's deliberations. So, what would be the incremental benefit you would see that observation, as opposed to a monitoring of the process, would bring?
It depends, I think, exactly what that monitoring means. I mean, the benefits we see in observation, and I mean, as securities regulators, we sort of observe in a number of fora, and the benefit of sort of direct observation is in ensuring, as I said, that the due process takes place, and that you're seen to be ensuring that it is taking place. Direct observation allows intervention where appropriate at an appropriate time and early in the stage before, there is any threat that due process does not take place. I mean, no one is, I think, anticipating that this, you know, that you should interfere with the technical things of it. It's making sure that the technicalities are thought of and are followed up on. We're not anticipating that this will lead necessarily to perfect standards up front. I think that's an aspirational goal that, you know, is unlikely. And a lot of the sort of things to do with how standards can be altered or improved comes with implementation and with observation of how that is interpreted then in a market-driven environment. But I think it, for me, the observation is ensuring that that due process takes place at the correct time. And that's the incremental benefit that you get from observing this process.
Just make one comment on that. All of us are conducting this discussion about the enhanced responsibilities of trustees in the due process. And we're doing it out of the presence of the person who chairs our due process committee, because what we're doing is committing him to further and further time involvement, yes, which is, of course, the way to do this. But it's something we need to keep in mind, just how one measures the cost-benefit of further trustee involvement in what could become a very, very dramatic increase in time commitment involvement.
I'll just add to that point. Part of the practical difficulties of having direct observation is that our trustees are spread throughout the world. They are volunteers, whereas at the securities regulators who observe, most of the people are full-time employees of the securities regulator, and they are paid to do the observation. Whereas, and the question is whether, if you, and this may be a way to go, I'm not prejudging this point, but whether it changes the fundamental nature of the trustees when they are requested to observe every detail of the ISB's deliberations, and whether you start changing the types of individuals who would be available for that responsibility. It's just a practical element to it.
Okay.
All I was going to try and sort of interject on your comment was to say I don't think it's the observation that is important here. I think what's important is actually the visibility and the transparency of the process. The visibility is that the trustees are exercising their duties effectively and that they are providing the oversights that they are worried about. Because I think what you hear again and again from various constituents is the fact that there has been little visibility around the roles that the trustees have been fulfilling, some of it around the being more visibly ambassadorial in how they promote the use of IFRS, some of it in how they actually exercise their oversight duties. They were exercising their oversight duties, and there have been made quite a lot of useful enhancements. So, like the Due Process Oversight Committee, if it is indeed a substantive oversight, going back to Peter's point earlier on, I think should improve the overall perception of how the trustees are acting and fulfilling their duties.
I just point out, in our paper, we say that the Due Process Committee will make regular reports to the trustees and in its annual report, so there'll be much more visibility, I think, going forward. And I think your point's well taken.
There's a new website for the Due Process Committee.
It has its own website.
And, I mean, to show the dramatic difference, I began a year and a few months ago as a trustee. The Due Process Committee, which I serve on, was meeting four times a year,
And Tom gently said, it won't be that bad a burden as I began. We're now meeting every month, and lots of paper is flowing, and it has to be for us to do that job, and the job we're contemplating in the review. But it is a much more demanding world.
Tom is totally misleading you. We're still a commissioner of the SEC. I think you bring a case against
him. In fact, for many trustees, it is becoming significantly greater burden than being a non-executive director on a major corporation. It's becoming a much greater time commitment. So I think the point that's been made as of trying to establish an appropriate balance is very important. And an element that hasn't been focused on, be interested whether anybody holds a view on this, is that there is going to be staff support which didn't previously exist. So an element that hasn't been focused on is the degree to which the staff directly accountable to the Due Process Oversight Committee are able to carry out some of the detailed work to ensure that when the IASB board members appear to report in front of the Due Process Oversight Committee, that committee is well armed with the right information and the right questions to ask. And all of that is new and just starting now.
Yeah. Peter, you had a comment.
Yeah, I was actually going to make a comment along those lines. Can I back up a little bit and say I think the responsibilities or differentiation of responsibilities between the monitoring board and the trustees is very clear. The transparency may be something else, but the split is clear. I think with the DPSC, it's essential, and it's a very, very good move forward, but it does introduce that line of decision as to at what point you're delving too deep and doing the job of the people. I think it's terribly difficult to make that judgment. My sense is you've got it about right at this point. And certainly, I think that to some extent, you could view it almost like the audit committee of the trustees, in that you are reviewing, you know, the processes and the operational processes of the ISAB, but you're not actually going to be doing the work for them. But you are also there to ask those difficult questions, and particularly what's in the public interest and what's in the long-term interest and those sorts of things. And it's probably wise, in truth, to have a clear delineation of precisely how far you will go. But I agree, sitting on a supervisory board of FRAG myself, and FRAG is primarily technical accountants, we face the same sort of issues to ensure that we are educated enough to be able to make the right decisions and not get hoodwinked by technicalities. And also springs to mind, which probably won't be proper comment around the table actually, but there's the old adage about engineers and whether engineers are actually the best people to run a company. They might know technically how everything operates, but they don't necessarily know how it fits together with everything else in the world. And again, it's providing that balance to ensure the accounting standard is not only technically correct, but also right for what the world needs at this point.
I want to come back to a comment you made in passing again about the governance structure, and Andrew, you did as well. In some sense, the refinement of that is in the places where the various levels interface with each other, and it's important to get those right. There are pieces of that in the governance paper of the monitoring board. For example, its involvement in the choice of the chairman of the trustees, and also, of course, its involvement in other decisions of the choice of the board chair as well. So I take right with there's statements in the monitoring board paper about just what is its involvement in those various levels, and also in our paper. And I think it's important to the extent you have views on that that you make them known, because, as you suggest, in some ways, the way this structure will operate depends on the details of those interfaces.
I'd like to make a comment. There are not many global bodies around that are going to be as significant to the economic development of the world as the R4S group. If the US and Japan, and indeed others, sign up, then something like 70% of the world is going to be using these accounting standards. Now, there are global bodies around where the accountability has been questioned, whether valid or not. FIFA is the obvious example in recently. Football, actually, however emotive subject it is, doesn't matter. This does. And I don't think it will be wise to take any risks with the quality of the governance. And that's why I believe the transparency of the monitoring board, which does have a very thin remit, but the transparency of how they make their choices, of the chairman in particular and the trustees, is of critical importance. And that has public accountability and transparency and indeed clarity. Because if you have the wrong chair, who in judges the wrong culture, that's something we don't want to really face. So I think the world ought to be absolutely interested in how this governance structure is going to work.
Very good. On process, in a sense, we've been discussing now process for the last 10 or 15 minutes. Are there other comments you'd want to make broadly on the process, really on items C1 through C5? So C5, of course, discusses how we would encourage an active role of national and other accounting standard setters. So beyond what you've already said, are there other points you would like to raise with us on the whole range of process? Again, much of our discussion has been on process.
Just one very brief point. It's perhaps a little bit more detailed than you would want here, but one thing that has been very welcome on the Advisory Council is the more regular and constant involvement of the trustees in sitting in meetings and hearing the discussion. And I wonder whether that might also usefully fit into the oversight and due process that you've got as trustees, given that the Advisory Council is advising the ISB, and you might have an interest in knowing how much attention is paid to it. I'm not suggesting it isn't, but it might just be an additional enhancement.
Fair point. Jeff, and then
just a note on field testing. Other people have mentioned field testing today. My experience from the FASB in the United States is that it was very difficult for them to get volunteers for field testing. I wouldn't underestimate how hard that is. I agree with field testing. I think field testing provided some excellent input, but it's very difficult to get volunteers because it's a very time-consuming process. Given all the different groups and individuals that have been suggesting field testing, perhaps a good exercise would be to keep a list of all those individuals, and then when the time comes for field testing,
and keep going back to them until they're completely worn down.
It would be interesting to see how many of them volunteered to participate in the field testing. Just a thought.
It's a little bit of an iterative process, too, because as you're developing a standard, you have all sorts of different ideas on how you might go. Now, at what point do you start testing those ideas? Because a lot of them will be thrown out, and you'll waste people's time testing. So it's a very judgmental thing as you go as to when you should get to a field testing stage.
And I do think Ian's early comment is terribly important, that we, in the end, want to get standards out. And so we've got to be careful that there's a balance in how we use these obviously important new mechanisms, or at least for us, expanded mechanisms.
Just a few points very quickly. I do think it's very important that we note that adding new layers of due process could well start to impede operational efficiency, and I think it's something that trustees are going to have to keep under close review, actually, as we go forward. On C3... We've touched on effects analysis, but I do think it's really important that we should develop a robust and widely accepted methodology here, and for that analysis to be embedded from a very early stage. I think it will lead to much better agenda setting as we go forward. So under C4 on the second bullet, establishing channels of communication, I think that's a really important way of addressing divergence, but I just think the list of appropriate bodies there is perhaps drawn up rather narrowly under the second bullet. I think you could include, for example, business organisations and user associations and professional accountancy bodies in that list. It will be very important in sort of keeping their ears to the ground. And I just wanted to make one final point. It's just backtracking slightly, but it's relevant here under due process. I do think defining this interface between the monitoring board and the trustees is a critical issue at this juncture, I think, and this is the time to get it right and provide some clarity. And as I listening to the points being made, including by Sam, they were very interesting and reassuring. I just wanted to highlight one point that made me just slightly uneasy, and it may be unfounded, but the fifth bullet under B2, it lists the responsibilities of the monitoring board, and it says there that it refers to the right of the monitoring board to refer to the ISB matters of broad public interest related to financial reporting, and that may be fine, but I wondered whether with all of the other due process and governance improvements outlined in the paper, whether that was really necessary. And I guess the slight concern I had was that if it offered a means by which the monitoring board can recommend particular issues for inclusion on the ISB's technical agenda, then you might at the very least give rise to an unwelcome perception that the independence of the ISB in certain circumstances might be conditional. I may misunderstand what's intended.
Well, just on item 5, I think, to the one to which you're referring.
Yes, it is.
It says, through the IFRS Foundation trustees to refer for consideration by the ISB matter of broad public.
Yeah.
It's quite careful to say that, and I think we're very sensitive to just what you said, but it is careful to say that this is done through the...
I appreciate it. Yeah, it would be done through the trustees, and that's a welcome safeguard, but it's still it begs a few questions.
Just to be clear, this is the current position under the...
I appreciate it's the current
position. Never understand it, and, you know, to some extent, when it was created, it's a reflection of the policy statement that exists between the U.S. SEC and the FASB. All it says is that they have the right to refer issues, just like other stakeholders have the right to refer issues. What's different is that we'd have to give it explicit, the board would have to give an explicit response on why it did or did not take a specific action. But I guess the view was that this was consistent with practice between securities regulators and other standards throughout the world, and we wanted to replicate that relationship with the monitoring board and us, and so it wasn't an unreasonable position. We are sensitive to the very point.
I think that's fine. I just think when we have a critical debate at the moment about the interfaces, what exactly this means and how it might work in practice, the implications are something worth bearing in mind.
With the several minutes we have left, let me just bring you to the issue of funding again, and remind you, as we have discussed before, we quickly acknowledge that the current funding mechanism doesn't meet all the criteria we've set out, but that what we do suggest is that in order to preserve the independence of ISB and the standard setting within the framework of public accountability, these are the characteristics that we seek, recognizing, again, from country to country, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the actual details are going to differ from the session. But if they can meet these criteria, be consistent with these criteria, that we should be then able to preserve the independence of the process and its public. Just ask for further comments on that.
Bob, I want to ask Jeff a question. As the CII has laid out the 7 requirements and explicitly you addressed the one on financing, does the CII accept the fact that there's we're in the horns of a dilemma here? That the major area of volunteer financing that we have is coming from the U.S. and that until the U.S. makes its move and decision, we are at a disadvantage on that subject. And once the U.S. SEC makes its decision, then we see that as being potentially and probably very quickly resolved. So if you expect us to resolve it before the decision's made, then we're never going to get to the answer. And I assume the CIA understands that's where we are. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, the way our policies are written, it says unless and until these criteria are met. I would assume the SEC could set up their decision so that the criterion would be met before we replace U.S. GAAP or move to IFRS in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I assume it would be part of their decision would include a question of dealing with the issue of funding. They've been very cooperative around it. It's just a condition precedent that they have to make the decision before they fund. The second point that I wanted to be sure the CII had a point of view around, we see as a trustees that the diversity of funding is as important as almost any other factor in funding. The fact that we may have, some have suggested in these discussions that government funding is not the best answer because governments can be even more challenging than private enterprise in telling you what they want. The U.S. Senate has done it. The EU Commission has done it. We've seen it before. But the fact that your funding is very diverse across a broad range of countries means that you are not dependent on any one source. And I would hope that the CII would build that into their assessment of what stable funding really means. Stable funding is not only a long-term source, it's a diverse source of funding that gives you a chance to say no if pressure comes from one of the places.
I think our reference to independent funding source, I think, would encompass having a broad range of funding.
With that, we've come to the end of the time that we agreed to impose ourselves upon you. And I do want to thank you again, all, for being willing to take the time to share your views with us. This is, as I think I said earlier, the last of six roundtables we've held around the world that have been immensely useful to us on what we take to be as important a task as trustees we could undertake. So thank you again for sharing with us your time and your wisdom. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you.